Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. I appreciate you being here. I just wrapped up what I believe is a very important conversation with Joe Consorti, analyst at the Bitcoin Layer. Joe is, I think, one of the best young financial macro minds in the space and is very articulate in his thoughts. And what I wanted to do was, as a non-finance person, get to the basics, like the mechanisms by which we have arrived in this financial mess that we find ourselves. And I thought Joe was a great person for the job. He did an unbelievable job explaining everything for me, answering my somewhat dumb questions. But if you are like me and you don't have a finance or an economics background, I think this is an episode you're really going to enjoy. All righty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Joe here. Joe, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
For sure. Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
I appreciate it. Hey, well, before we get into all the fun stuff, I want to ask you a quick question of personal curiosity. So your banner picture on X appears to be you shredded for a physique competition or something like that. Can you explain the backstory of that?
Yeah. So when I was, I've been doing bodybuilding since I was ninth or 10th grade. And so that was my 18th birthday present. My dad got me the entry fee into a bodybuilding competition. So that was in May of 2019. Obviously it's almost 5 years after that now, but yeah, that was a while ago. It was a fun time. And the unfortunate thing is those two other guys up on stage with me were two twin 24-year-old firefighters. And 5 years on, I'm not even 24 yet. So they were the oldest and the most shredded to the gills that you could possibly be. So that's why in my photo, they're doing a side chest pose and I'm doing an ab vacuum. Because if I was doing a side chest pose, they would be much bigger than me. And so that's the backstory behind the photo.
Dude, that's awesome. So are you still doing anything like that? Or is that just like a moment in time?
No, so I haven't competed in 5 years, but I'm still doing bodybuilding just recreationally.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, awesome. Well, hey, as I told you before we jumped online, I've been following you for quite some time. I've been in the space a lot less time than many people who I sort of want to talk to, folks like yourself. Before we jump into really the meat of the episode, I'm curious, could you give a background on how you came into Bitcoin, your work at the Bitcoin Layer, just sort of what your transition into Bitcoin, what you are doing today?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I came into Bitcoin. I was at the University of Vermont studying business, and I was in a class with a man by the name Tyler LaRoche. He currently works at BTC Inc., but he introduced me to Bitcoin. We became good friends that semester, the semester we were down there, which was the fall semester, and then into some of the spring semester. We got sent home for COVID, and that summer, I started running a painting business here in my hometown and the surrounding area. And then I had, after that summer where I did that, I decided to take an at-home year because, you know, why pay for room and board when I have to, you know, go around, wear a mask everywhere. There's a mandate, what have you, and save some money. Also much easier to do courses when it's all, you know, in a screen, you don't have to walk anywhere. And so that was my thinking. And I had a great deal of capital to deploy at the end of the summer. I did, about $100,000 in revenue. And then I had about 20% profit margin. So I had 19, 21K to put somewhere. And at the time I wasn't in a specialized field in business. I was just kind of generically in business. I like talking. I knew that that's something I wanted to do. And so that's kind of why I pursued business initially. I wanted to go into medicine. I ended up going into business because I like talking. But at the time, I hadn't necessarily decided where. And so I didn't have a specialty. So I wasn't all that immersed in markets just yet. So my buddy started talking to me about Bitcoin. Tyler started talking to me about Bitcoin. It was this asset that had obviously crashed pretty hard toward the start of the year. And at the time, I was becoming kind of literate in the Bloomberg terminal and studying markets. And that was something that I was, growing interested in. And so moving into finance and economics, those are things that I wanted to do. I was curious at how all this worked. And I love studying relationships and understanding the inner workings of things. And so markets have just been really interesting for a very long time for me. And so around that time that I was getting into markets, Tyler also introduced me to to Bitcoin. And, you know, me being someone who could afford to go out really far in the risk curve, I just decided to put basically all of, you know, every cent that I had earned into Bitcoin at the time that it was, you know, around $9,000, $9,000, $10,000. And I went on that crazy run up to its all-time high the following April. And in that interim period, I, you know, became completely mesmerized by this asset. What is this? I read two books that Tyler had sent me prior to becoming so convicted in this asset. And those were The Masters and Slaves of Money by Breedlove, and then The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Boyapati. And both of those are still on my shelf. Well, not The Masters and Slaves of Money, but The Bullish Case for Bitcoin is still on my shelf. That's off screen right now. And became enamored with it, started buying a whole lot of it, bought a whole lot of it, still holding a whole lot of it. And I lost all of it in a boating accident. For posterity. I don't own any Bitcoin anymore.
Didn't we all?
Yeah. And all of us. No, nobody owns any Bitcoin. But
I know.
Yeah. And so I started researching markets, and really Bitcoin as an asset, it kind of fascinated me how it fit into everything. And so I started tweeting basically just what I was finding, my market thoughts around, I want to say, the fall of the following year. Really, I had just spent a year kind of getting immersed in this thing, obviously still studying up at school. I did the painting business again the following summer. I did $250,000 in revenue that summer. And then margin was way worse because I was running teams all over the state instead of just around me. And so had to pay out a whole lot more, and I scaled out a bit. But then that fall, I started tweeting. And that's kind of where my Twitter journey began. So in the fall of 2021, I started tweeting. So now 2.5 years ago, I suppose. And that spring, I came into contact with Nick Bhatia through a mutual friend, Matt Snow, who works at Trammell Venture Partners, which is a Bitcoin native venture capital firm in Austin, Texas. And I got into contact with Nick, and I've been working as an analyst with Nick for 2 years since. And that's been wonderful. We've turned the Bitcoin layer from kind of a, I don't want to say fledgling, but a small publication that was kind of a pseudo sequel to Nick's book, but it was a living, breathing Substack. And we turned it into a fully fledged multimedia research publication syndicated across YouTube, podcast platforms, Zero Hedge, Twitter, all of it. And so it's been a very fun ride. It's essentially, I've considered it my grad school for these last 2 years. And, all the while, of course, I've been posting all my thoughts on Twitter at the same time. So that's how I got into all this crazy stuff. Right place, right time,
very cool.
Right people surrounding me.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. Your role today, I mean, most of what you do is analyze, write, speak, you know, podcast appear, you know, these sorts of things, and represent the Bitcoin layer and your thesis for Bitcoin macro. Is that how you'd sort of summarize what it is that you do on a daily basis?
Yeah, exactly. I tweet, I write. Essentially, I get paid to synthesize financial markets through a Bitcoin lens, in the simplest terms that I can. And it's still something that I'm very much mm-hmm. learning to do. But yeah, that's 100% my job description for sure. Basically answer the why Bitcoin question like a million different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I think that's a good segue into really what I wanted to have you talk about here today. So as I told you offline, I've been in Bitcoin about 2 years. And over those 2 years, I've listened to, I mean, probably thousands of podcast episodes at this point, multiple a day most of the time, and at least hundreds that with an emphasis on macro finance, and it's not my background. And I haven't really, outside of podcasts, like dug in deep on this. And so it's a world that I would say when I hear you talk, you know, 20% of it, 40% of it on a good day, I get. And I think conceptually I understand the mess that we're in, but I have a hard time understanding the mechanisms by which we are in this mess, how decisions are made around, you know, monetary policy, all of these sorts of topics. And so what I was hoping to do is maybe just kind of ask you my own curiosities about these subjects. And hopefully it's a resource that a lot of people like myself who again, sort of conceptually get it, but really don't understand the mechanisms can begin to follow a little more closely. And I'll be curious to at the end to hear some of the resources you might recommend for someone like myself who is trying to better understand this. So I guess my question is, how would you begin to explain to someone who is maybe just completely, you know, they understand grocery prices are going up and that, but they don't really understand the financial mess that the United States is in. How would you begin to frame that for them in a way that your average, you know, average person would comprehend?
Right. Yeah. So it all begins with what we started doing in 1971. So money as we know it is just a communication mechanism. It's just a universal language, right? We can't talk to one another and we can't exchange value for not speaking the same language. And so US dollars, that's our agreed upon language for expressing value. And what happened, the way we did this before 1971 was with gold bars. And the United States dollar was just a piece of paper that represented part of a gold bar, right? And that meant that this gold bar, right, it was physical reality. It was something that was tangible, and it was something that was difficult to create more of. And so as a result of that, money held its value really well. The United States dollar did a really good job at doing what it was supposed to do, which is express value, because the dollar was tied to physical reality. Fast forward to 1971, and President Nixon removed the backing of the US dollar from gold. And so the dollar used to represent X units of gold. And then following August of 1971, we completely detached the US dollar from gold and started printing dollars in well in excess of the amount of gold that the United States held. And so in 1971, there was kind of this point where economic reality and the US dollar as a pricing mechanism were going up in the, you know, the exact same direction at the exact same speed. And then all of a sudden, come 1971, economic reality is staying on this plane because you can't change that by printing more units of something. But the pricing mechanism started to go like this, right? And so we started printing dollars well in excess of the gold that the United States had. And that's excellent for the United States because everyone's holding the US dollar. After World War II, the United States became the global reserve currency at the Bretton Woods Conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. It's actually pretty close to me where I am currently. And we really hit the jackpot because post-World War II, all of this economic flourishing has happened. So all of global economic expansion, globalism, everything we're experiencing today came after World War II, basically. And so, you know, global trade routes, global commerce relationships, all of it, most of it that we experience today came after the economic boom that followed World War II. So we lucked out because now everyone's holding dollars. And so it makes it really easy for us to print all these dollars, create all this money, well in excess of the gold that we have in reserve. And the way that we do this is through something called fractional reserve lending. Okay. And what that means is when you take out a loan from a bank, they're not going back into their bank vault, getting your money and then giving it to you. They're creating new money out of thin air. This is what banks have the ability to do. And they're doing it with collateral that doesn't equal your loan amount, collateral that is far lower than your loan amount. And what this does is it creates new money. It prints new money into thin air. Now, what this does, obviously, it means that there are more dollars chasing fewer and fewer goods. And so the price of those goods increases. If you have $1 and one piece of bread, then, you know, those are the only two units of anything in your economy. That piece of bread may cost $1. But if you have $1,000 and one piece of bread, well, those are the only two things to exchange. Your piece of bread costs $1,000. And so the amount of dollars in existence has been rising, and the pace that it's rising has been accelerating. At the same time, that the United States has kind of been on a totally linear economic growth path year over year. Now, of course, that's compounding. So, you know, 2% every single year, that's compounding. But by the same token, the rate at which we're printing dollars is much higher. And so that's why since 1970, you have seen home prices completely detach from real wages adjusted for inflation. You have seen food prices adjusted for completely surpass real wages adjusted for inflation. It's now, rather than being like a 3-to-1 or a 4-to-1 multiple of annual income to buy a median home in the United States, or excuse me, like a 2-to-1 multiple, which it was in, you know, 1971, 2 or 3 years of your annual salary. That's the median price of a home. Now it's 10 times. The multiple is 10x what your median income is to buy a home. So that's the result of the last 53 years of this experiment that we're living in, where instead of money just being a communication language for physical reality, now it is the way that bankers have used to enrich themselves. So we've detached it from gold. We've printed money in excess of gold. We've extended all this credit, as much credit as we can, because that's how we've been measuring economic growth. But we have been the release valve for everything that has gone wrong with that. Gen Z, my generation, owns basically no assets, and we're totally priced out of owning assets. Not me being defeatist in saying that. It's just the reality that the data paints. The median income of a college graduate with a business degree, for example, is something like $80,000, $90,000. The median home price here in Massachusetts, where I am, is something like $700,000. Okay, so when I said that multiple used to be like 2 or 3x your wages to your annual salary to what the home prices were, now it's 10x. Mm-hmm. Or more. And so that's kind of what has happened over the last several years. The big problem is we've printed money in excess of the amount of physical reality that we have. So everything's gotten more expensive because of it. And it's not going to change, because that's how we measure economic growth. We measure economic growth by the amount of spending that occurs rather than the quality of spending that occurs. And so then it becomes a question of, well, what do we do? And that's on us. We need to insulate ourselves from all of this monetary tomfoolery and buy something that they can't make more of. And for me, for many other people, because of how divisible it is and the fact that it's the only absolutely scarce asset in the world, that is Bitcoin. We insulate ourselves by buying Bitcoin.
I think that's an awesome synopsis. So a couple of questions for you then on that. So why is it that... You know, the cost of a home, it makes sense. You've got the same number, the same or a more slowly growing number of goods and services that are being chased after by an ever increasing volume of money. So it makes sense that why isn't the cost of labor, in other words, wages that people are being paid, keeping up with the pace of goods? You know, like why if inflation is 8%, you know, we can argue that that's evil anyway. It's theft. But if wages are keeping up, increasing by 8% a year also, then at least people aren't falling behind. Why is it that wages move differently than the cost of goods and services generally?
Right. A lot of it has to do with the wealth effect, right? So when we talk about asset ownership and you look at what's happened since the 1970s, the aggregate net worth of people who've owned assets has hockey sticked up and to the right, whereas the people who haven't owned assets hasn't. And so when you have assets, you can borrow against those assets, right? And when the value of your assets has been appreciating for 5 decades straight, you can buy way more than people who do not have assets, okay? And so the wealth effect has allowed spending to rise precipitously. So the cost of goods and services have outstripped wages. And so wage growth is more in line. Obviously, you know, adjusting for inflation, asset prices, you know, if you were to take asset prices and then also we're talking monetary inflation, asset prices, then wages, you adjust both for inflation. Wages have severely underperformed, and it has to do with the wealth effect, because asset owners, they leverage their assets and then buy more assets. And so that's why you've seen the the price of goods and services rise relative to wages, which just haven't been able to keep up.
So basically, asset owners, the 50% or whatever percent of people who are most fortunate in our country, are bidding up the price of goods and services because they have this newfound wealth. And so the people who are maybe their wages in the bottom 50% or whatever the, you know, the percentile is, they might still be earning a little bit more nominally each year, but they're just being crushed by the inflation caused by people in the upper 50% or whatever bidding up prices. Is that maybe a way of framing it?
Correct. And in an actually productive society, you wouldn't just be able to be a rent seeker that owns assets and then captures cash flow and then does virtually nothing. You wouldn't be able to do that. You would need to be the most efficient capital allocator. But when the Federal Reserve says that we need price inflation to go up by 2% a year, therefore we need X amount of lending to occur, we need, right? Then you could just kind of sit on your hands and do nothing, and you earn more money. You can borrow more. You can leverage what you have more, and you could just continue cranking it up from there. That wouldn't exist in an economy that wasn't credit-based and didn't have fractional reserve lending, but that's the world that we live in. And so that's essentially what has occurred time and time again over the last 50 years.
And that's what, when people talk about like the financialization of our economy, that's effectively what is that there are people who make their entire living by betting on certain asset class, like they're effectively leveraging or taking advantage of very low interest rates, taking out massive loans, using their existing assets as collateral, and nothing is being produced, right? Is that, that's sort of what we're talking about?
Correct. The wealth, instead of accumulating to the net producers, of course, it still is accumulating to the net producers. Don't get me wrong. Not to demoralize people who are listening to this. You should be a net producer. And in all that you do, you should work to be a net producer, produce more than you consume, and add value, and value will come to you. Don't get it twisted. But that is the reality. Yeah. Instead of the wealth being funneled solely to the net producers, it is funneled more so to the asset owners. And you have benefited from just asset owning, rent seeking behavior, because instead of having to be marginally more productive than the guy next to you, you've just had to own a bigger house than the guy next to you, or, you know, more land than the guy next to you, right? So that's essentially what has occurred. That's the distortion that has been caused by what we did in 1971.
Got it. And I don't think we've gotten more responsible since. So 10 days ago, you tweeted, you said, COVID is over, yet the United States is borrowing 2.5x what it was borrowing pre-pandemic, $10 trillion in annual debt issuance in 2019, now $25 trillion in 2024 and climbing. They're looting the coffers in broad daylight. It's not that complicated. So could you explain what that means? Who's controlling how much debt is being issued? I think this is some of the mechanistic stuff I'm interested in. And then who's doing the looting and benefiting from it, like specifically? Is it politicians? Is it, you know, the special interest groups? Maybe start there.
For sure. Yeah. So basically we're at a situation now where the United States debt to GDP is 126%, and GDP in and of itself is an inaccurate way of measuring economic growth. Cause like I said, it relies on amount of spending rather than quality of spending and investment. And so just putting that aside, let's say GDP is a good measure of economic growth, then at 126% debt to GDP, that means that we need more debt in order to maintain the same level of economic growth, not a higher level of economic growth, but the same level. So that means debt is becoming less productive. One unit of debt is today is less productive than one unit of debt a decade ago. And on the current trend, one unit of debt a decade from now is going to be less productive than one unit of debt today. And so
can you explain why that is? like what that means exactly. Like why is a unit of debt less productive today than it was a decade ago?
It's just the relationship you're witnessing with debt to GDP rising, the ratio between the two rising, but GDP isn't rising.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. Exactly. And so now what we've seen and what you'll continue to see just to maintain 2% nominal GDP is for debt, the issuance of debt to rise and rise and rise and rise. And so then what does the United States do? What are the two paths out of this? Well, the one path out of this is austerity, raising taxes at the same time that we cut federal spending. And that'll induce a multi-year, probably decade or more long recession if we were to fix this problem in order to bring the national debt way down, completely wipe out all of this misallocated capital, where things that are where they shouldn't be. That's one way we could fix this, raising taxes while simultaneously cutting federal spending. But that's a good way for no politician to ever get elected again. Okay. So that's not going to happen. So then the alternative, how do we burn down the value of this debt? Because this is really bad. And other countries are faced with the exact same thing. It's a global issue, but for the United States to be facing it, it is also very bad. Don't get me wrong. We're an economic powerhouse. The power of technology is making it so that we are becoming more productive as the days go by, as the weeks go by, but not nearly productive enough to be able to catch up to the amount of debt growth that we've had and the amount of debt growth that has kind of enabled all of this economic flourishing. So it becomes a question of like, how on earth do we solve this? How do we make it so the United States can burn down the value of this debt? And then the only solution that's left is financial repression. So letting price inflation run higher than interest rates for a prolonged period of time in order to erode the value of the debt that we have. And that's the solution that we've chosen. That's the solution that we are choosing actively. So right now, rates being where they are, it's putting the US Treasury in a huge bind, because annual interest payments used to represent something like $300 billion. Now they're $1.1 trillion. And before the end of the year, they're going to be $1.5 trillion annually. And that represents 40% of tax receipts now. And it's going to represent 50% of tax receipts by the time the year is through, or 60, closer to 60. And that's really bad. That's extremely bad, because tax receipts represent government revenue that is non-debt government revenue. And if we're using more than half of our non-debt government revenue in order to pay off interest expense, that's very bad. And if we continue, the way we continue down that path is if we leave interest rates where they are. The good thing about leaving interest rates where they are is it eventually, in theory, will induce an economic slowdown that will bring prices, price inflation back down to target. But we haven't seen that yet. So we're in a situation now with high prices, high inflation, and the US Treasury is getting squeezed. And so the path forward is we're going to have to slash interest rates in order for the US Treasury to remain able to pay its bills. And so what's going to happen at that stage is price inflation is stuck. CPI inflation is stuck at 3%. It's been stuck there for a year, above 3% rather, closer to 3.5%, which is really terrible. It's almost two times faster than the rate of inflation we've always experienced. And so that's why price inflation now more than ever is a real hot button issue for people. And so with price inflation stuck where it is, the Fed forced to cut in order to, you know, support the US Treasury, then that, chances are, is going to reaccelerate price inflation back to 4, up to 4.5, maybe 5. And I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but that's the situation that we're in. In order for the US Treasury to have any hope whatsoever of eroding the value of this, of its massive pile of debt, it needs to erode the value of the US dollar by making it so that prices are going up at a rate that is higher than the annual rate you can get on US Treasury securities. And so that's what they've chosen. That's what they've chosen. Financial repression. Make it so that price inflation runs hot, hotter than the investable yield that you can get on a U.S. Treasury security, basically making every U.S. dollar holder underwater, making it so there are very few escape valves from any of this. And that's what we've chosen. We're at the stage now where essentially any idea of like austerity through raising taxes and cutting federal spending, that's totally been abandoned. We're regularly adding $1 trillion to the debt every 90 days. I tweeted out soon it'll be every 30 days. Because again, it's the path that we're headed. We're just on an accelerating trend. They've demonstrated time and time again. They don't care about slowing it down. They don't work for us. And so again, it all kind of comes back to at the individual level. What can you do? What do you want? How are you going to insulate yourself? And the answer is that you need to own assets, and you need to own assets that they can't make more of. And so for everybody listening, not financial advice, but just be a net producer as much as you can be. And then make sure that, you know, you have cash flow, of course, in whatever endeavor it may be, whether it's your salary, whether it's a business you have, or both, which I'd advise, and then allocate to what they can't make more of. Because the path forward is very simple. They're going to let inflation run hot. It's the only way to erode the value of the debt. And in the meantime, they're going to continue spending like there's no tomorrow. Because as I said, we need to maintain positive 2% GDP growth, but only nominally, right? And so in that time, real rates will be negative, real GDP will be negative, price inflation will be rising. The headlines will read the economy has never been better, while medical school graduates will not be able to find a home to live in. Newly graduated engineers will not be able to find a home to live in. So the propaganda is going to get worse. The national debt is going to continue accelerating in its rise and its ascent. And they're not going to pump the brakes and reverse course. They're pushing their foot on the accelerator. Okay. So then it just becomes a matter of, we need to insulate ourselves. We need to protect ourselves. That's why Bitcoin.
Yeah. So that all makes a lot of sense. So who are the people benefiting from this? Like when you refer to the looting, they're looting the coffers in broad daylight. Is the issuance of debt, how is the issuance of debt benefiting certain people, and who are those certain people that it's benefiting?
Right. So the Cantillon effect, those who are closest to the money printer, they benefit the most. And that includes people with banking license, people who own assets. So that's one. But of course, when it comes to debt, it's a little bit different. A great deal of these spending packages that we have now, it's just pure money laundering. There's no other way to put it. I mean, essentially what's happening is we are passing regularly, these eight-figure, nine-figure spending bills for foreign countries. And then what happens is those foreign countries, they then buy weapons from defense contractors based here in the United States. And regularly what you witness within that is they're buying bags of lug nuts for $500 and, you know, all this other stuff. Right. Essentially that's the funnel that's taking place. So not only the Cantillon effect that takes place through, people who have banking license, the lenders of the world, the rent seekers of the world, the asset owners of the world, that's kind of the Fed monetary policy side of how they're looting the coffers. But then on the debt side of things, it's a great deal of money laundering, and B, it's enriching the individuals who are supposed to be working for us. We're funding ourselves like there's no tomorrow, and we have all these massive, vast spending packages. And at the end of the day, it gets funneled right back into their pockets because the defense contractors are the donors for the politicians. And we're passing all of these bills for foreign countries to buy weapons and other things from defense contractors here in the United States. And then all that money is going back into the pockets of politicians and rinse and repeat. And the same thing with things like the pharmaceutical industry. Same exact thing. We're passing hundreds of billions of dollars for X, Y, and Z. And of course, severely overpricing what we're supposed to be spending it on. Things get purchased, and that money, a lot of it goes back into the campaign funding or donations to particular politicians. And so that is what's going on, both on the monetary side of things through asset owners and people with banking licenses benefiting from monetary inflation, because it means nominally they have more purchasing power now compared to people whose wages aren't keeping up, like we talked about earlier. And then on the fiscal side of things, it's the people who are enriching themselves with all of this spending, right? We've thrown away every idea of ever working for the American citizen through fixing this issue that we have. And we're doubling down on issuing as much debt as we can to all of the benefactors that we possibly can in the shortest amount of time that we can before people catch on and they start getting really upset. And we're not there yet. We're not there yet. I mean, people really don't understand what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a learning curve. And I mean, that's the thing is like, I've been listening to people and reading books and I'm still kind of wrapping my head around like, again, how all of this really happens. So let me just make sure, like, as an example. So politicians determine they want to issue more debt in order to fund the war in Ukraine, for example. So money goes to Ukraine, money is created, goes to Ukraine, and is then used to purchase munitions, whatever military, you know, they feed the U.S. military industrial complex, as an example again, who these politicians probably have large vested interests in, either from a funding perspective or they own stock or whatever the case may be. And so everyone sort of gets paid. And then that money eventually makes its way into the economy. But by that point in time, the Cantillon effect, prices have already been impacted by its initial, basically the people who got to it first got to benefit from that money's existence before we saw the inflation, the inflationary effect of that new money. Did I kind of get that right or approximately right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a mess. I mean, it makes so much sense though. And so the example I hadn't heard of, is like, well, or I guess I hadn't thought through is like that money from Ukraine comes back into the United States and funds all of these companies that, the military industrial complex or whoever it may be, or, we have COVID and that money gets dished out and eventually funnels back through the, Pfizer or whoever. So, okay. So I think all of this is making sense. I guess you sort of answered partially one question. Cause my head goes to, okay, well, how does this play out? And you know, austerity measures probably not going to happen. It's not the path that we seem to be, we haven't chosen historically. We don't seem to be choosing. I think each generation gets worse and worse in terms of their view of government. Like they view government as a safety valve or a safety net, and the demands on politicians for handouts only increases with time. So not going to happen. So they're going to effectively, I mean, QE is coming and it's been here a long time, but it ebbs and flows. What is the, like, I guess what I'm trying to still sort through, like, here's my thesis. Tell me if this makes sense. The first place we're going to like really see cracks, besides, I think people don't even realize banks are failing and all of that. Like the place where people are going to wake up is, I think, social unrest. Like when a large group of people simply can no longer afford to live life, to your point, like doctors can't afford houses. Well, imagine if you're not a doctor and you're not making $200,000 a year, what your grocery costs and utility costs are as those prices increase. Eventually enough people are going to break, I think, and I don't know, take to the streets, loot stores. I mean, we've seen a lot of crazy stuff in the last decade, and that's maybe where I feel like we're headed. Not to be a doomer, but it just seems reasonable to expect that people are going to get desperate. Where do you see the initial cracks come in as things begin to really melt down?
I think social unrest is a very good release valve, and you hit the nail on the head, because again, like the reason I've tweeted this out several times that all they have left is propaganda. It's true. They've been lying to you, and that's really all that they have is to continue lying to you, because if they spoke in honest terms about what's going on. Oh yeah, the United States debt to GDP ratio is going to be 200% by 2040. Yeah, it's looking more like 2030. There's not much you can do about it. The price inflation problem, that's not going away. you know, it's they're going to continue outpacing your wages. There's nothing we can do about it. And, you know, we're not going to correct course. If that was said, there'd be riots in the streets, right? If people understood what was happening to them, there'd be riots in the streets. So you're right. Social unrest kind of is the valve that unfortunately I think that this will take in order to effectuate change, because they're not doing it of their own accord. They're clearly not. They're not making any change because it's the right thing to do. There are very few, if any, politicians in DC who work that way. They work in order to enrich themselves through enriching their donors, and that's it. And so I do believe, unfortunately, that the release valve is going to be civil unrest. Just like, you know, all change has been effectuated through civil unrest. That's how it's going to be. Eventually, there's going to be a breaking point for people who just can't continue to stomach what's been happening to them, and that will unfortunately be the route that it takes. And I think, unfortunately, there will be, you know, there's heading into November. This is a very very tense election season. This one in particular, there is a lot of emotionality going around. You know, people on both sides who are very, very, very adamant about their guy. And I have a feeling that if it doesn't go one way or the other, there's going to be a lot of, you know, uncivilized demonstrations, unfortunately. And that will be what we've seen accelerating the last several years is just symptomatic of the civil unrest I'm talking about is symptomatic of the money problem, and the problem that no one can articulate because financial illiteracy is intentional. If you knew what was going on, you would be marching on the U.S. Treasury right now, right? If everyone knew what was going on, we'd be marching on these institutions right now, but we don't. And that's the point. So widespread financial illiteracy is the biggest weapon against the ruling elite.
Yeah, it's always it's so interesting looking back at like old clips of Ron Paul and some of the things he was talking about. And at the time, I wasn't paying attention, you know, on that level. And the idea of ending the Fed, I didn't understand what that meant or why or you know whatever. But so many people, if they understood what you're talking about, they had that level of financial literacy, which it doesn't require a bunch of Joes walking around the world. I mean, I think you have a level that is incredibly helpful for in-depth analysis. But even if you just fundamentally sort of understood what money printing is doing, how it works a little bit, I think people would. Ron Paul's talking points that made him a very distant candidate for president would completely resonate. It's just like he sounds like a crazy person to most people. Like, and the Fed, like, don't we have to have the Fed? How could the government not be giving, you know, printing money and providing that service to the world or whatever? So it's interesting. So I agree on the social unrest. I'm curious though, social unrest doesn't actually resolve any of these issues. It doesn't make prices magically decrease, and stimulus checks to appease those people won't make prices decrease. Like, what is it that you view, like, what's your base case for how, like, maybe an approximate time frame? Is this over a decade, over 30 years, over 50 years? And how do we actually unwind from this problem ultimately? Because eventually it breaks something, you know, eventually it just no longer functions. What are your thoughts on that?
So what can we do, or what's the path forward?
Well, like how, what's your base case for how this does play out? So I agree with Bitcoin, I think is going to protect many of us. But let's assume 98% of people still don't have Bitcoin as things begin to unwind. Like, what's the experience of the average person going through the next 10, 20, 30, whatever timeline you think makes sense? What happens, and how do we go from 126% debt to GDP to fiscal responsibility? You know, like what's the way that that all plays out?
We don't get there. We're not going to. Obviously, there are going to be periods, there are going to be months and years of time where the deficit does decrease. We do become more productive relative to our debt. Things are looking up. But then at the first sign of crisis, because we can't have a prolonged recession, the Fed has demonstrated that time and time again, that at the first sign of crisis, it's just going to ease and do the same thing it's always done. And so there'll be periods where it seems like austerity is making a comeback and where it seems like positive real interest rates, i.e. a valid communication mechanism monetarily, is making a comeback. But then it'll be swiftly dashed once the next crisis comes about, whether it's in financial markets or whether it is in housing or whether it is in anywhere else. And so I don't believe
your base case. Sorry.
Yeah. So I don't believe that austerity is making a comeback in any way, shape, or form. I think that, the train is running off the tracks. Debt will not have a multi-year period of falling. I believe our debt to GDP ratio will continue rising as debt issuance accelerates and totally outstrips and overshadows all of the productivity gains we see as an economy. And the solution for everyone will be to hold on and hold on tightly and only have in cash what you need for your expenses. And of course, emergency expenses and rainy day fund, obviously. But it's very important for people to begin learning about and understanding assets, hard money assets more than anything, because the end game here is they're going to print. And you need to hold what they can't make any more of, because the denominator is becoming worthless toward infinity, asymptotic function approaching worthless infinity for the denominator, US dollars. And so you need to hold, a numerator that can't be debased beyond a certain point. That's gold. It is it's scarce, but as of last week or the week before, Bitcoin is more scarce than gold. And so have conviction in something. That's what I'd say. The people who are ambivalent about something, they're going to get completely smoked. And so you can, be on team US dollar and have faith in the United States that will turn this thing around. And I have faith in the United States, obviously. It's the greatest country on earth. However, I have more conviction in Bitcoin. I have more conviction in something that they can't make more of. And over the next several years, I feel confident enough in putting my name and my face and my job and reputation on the line to say that I don't think that we're going to reverse course fiscally or monetarily. I think this is the way things are. And so instead of the onus being on the government and the Federal Reserve to protect us, we have to protect ourselves. And I view Bitcoin as the best way of doing that.
So in your view, the transition, so Bitcoin wins and eventually your thesis is that the world operates on a Bitcoin standard, whatever timeline that may be. Is that, first of all, is that correct?
Yeah. So I think, denominating goods and services in Bitcoin, that is probably many, many, many decades off. But I do think that the US dollar is here to stay. It is the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry bucket, per se. And it is that dominance factor that we talked about. It's on every balance sheet. It underlies every trade. US treasuries are the collateral for all global lending within countries and between countries. So we have that benefit. And I don't think that's going to change over the next several decades, even as this debt problem just gets terrible. It gets so bad. Of course, Bitcoin isn't in any state right now to be a medium of exchange. It's still monetizing through its store of value phase. For it to be a good medium of exchange, it needs to be way bigger than it is now. Liquidity-wise, it needs to be closer to the U.S. Treasury market, which is $25 trillion in size. Bitcoin is $1.2 or $1.3 trillion. So I think eventually, Bitcoin does become something of a global currency. And it does start denominating goods and services. And like you phrased it, we operate on something like a Bitcoin standard. But I think that's, something I'll see in my later years, if I see it in my life. I do think the debt problem is terrible. Mm-hmm. I do think that people are going to be abandoning ship at an accelerating rate, as they already are. But, it's the Bitcoin standard. People beginning to price goods and services in Bitcoin, that needs to happen. That's something that's going to happen way after Bitcoin is no longer as volatile as it is now. Once its liquidity is magnified by at least 10x, by a factor of 10, and we're at $10 trillion in liquidity, which is around gold, and $25 or $30 trillion, that's when I'll be more confident that, okay, people are going to start using this as collateral, and people are going to start using this as a pricing mechanism. But in terms of liquidity, we're just not there yet. So I envision it as something that will happen decades from now, not years from now.
Okay. And do you think that transition, I mean, do you think the way that plays out is, or maybe the way that Bitcoin, even if the entire world isn't operating on Bitcoin standard, maybe the way it becomes more mainstream, does it require, like, are people going to bring out the guillotine for politicians, or is it going to be politicians reluctantly accepting Bitcoin as legal tender or something like that? Because the social unrest is so great, like the demand to do something is so great, but they printing more money, they can no longer fool anyone into thinking that that's a useful exercise. Like, how do you think that plays out? Is this like a bloody thing, or is it just we have, because we have this peaceful asset, it can be a smooth transition. We just need the right people helping to foster in this, this bright orange future.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, dollar hegemony is not going to go quietly. So I do think that, there will be strict capital controls. We're seeing it now, classifying hardware wallets as money transmitters or whatever is going on with the FBI right now and the DOJ. They're going to pull out every trick that they have in the hat in order to slow this thing down. They're not going to go quietly. And I certainly hope that it doesn't become bloody. But I also think that that's why at the beginning of this call, I said that I don't own any Bitcoin, because for the record, I own zero Bitcoin whatsoever. And it would behoove everybody to listening to not mention to people that you own any, just for posterity's sake. Not to be alarmist or anything, but again, this is the singular most valuable asset that man has ever known. Of course, I'm talking about money. There are far more valuable assets that man owns, a family, things of that sort, right? But monetarily, when we're talking about preserving wealth, this is the single greatest asset that man has ever known. And so it would behoove you to just not tell anyone about it. I certainly hope we don't get to that point, but I don't think that the US dollar's hegemony will go quietly. But I do think that just the inevitability of what's happening here will make it such that really nothing that the powers that be can do, other than, like I said, austerity. Austerity could kill Bitcoin. It could. All right. If the US dollar was a good store of value, it could. But it's not. So it would, since austerity is not an option, it would require, Bitcoin is the solution.
Yeah. I think it seems to me, and again, you have a much better perspective on this, it seems to me that the level of austerity that we would need to have is so great as to be impossible, even if technically it's achievable, right? Like, because it's not just, it wouldn't just be, hey, let's raise taxes, which by the way, might not be very effective in a recession. We can't control that. And it would also eventually require, we'll end up in this same loop if we don't go back to a gold standard or some standard where the dollar is just paper pegged to something scarce, like, right? I mean, this, we can keep playing the same game over and over. And maybe that could be the playbook, is, do a little bit of austerity to make it seem like we're, heading in the right direction. We cover some of our debt, things aren't as bad, but then 50 years from now, we've just reprinted and we're doing the same thing because there's no peg to anything scarce. So I don't know. I think you're right though. People can talk about the notion of austerity all day. I just think there's no political appetite, and there's no appetite from the people who are voting in the politicians either. Right. I mean, I just don't think anyone's up for it.
Yeah, no, not at all. No politician will get reelected on that platform. The people won't like it, even though it's their medicine. We need this. It's our medicine. Austerity is our medicine. A multi-year recession would be our medicine with no intervention whatsoever. Mm-hmm. That would be our medicine. That would be the world's medicine. We can vaporize all of this terrible debt. That would be the world's medicine. But we don't like taking our medicine, right? No politician will get reelected if they give the American people their medicine. Instead, we're giving ourselves shots of Narcan, right? Shots of adrenaline, rather, I suppose, would be a better way of saying it. So there's really no end in sight for all of this.
Yeah, crazy. Well, I got two more questions for you. So first of all, are there any, if I wanted to become just as smart as you and learn all this stuff, you know, gain your knowledge, are there books, newsletters, online courses, resources that I or others might be pointed toward?
Yeah, so I would go to the Bitcoin layer first and foremost. The sign is up in the background right there. It's not illuminated, but I would go to the Bitcoin layer. That is, we are an educational and research outlet that boils everything down to very, very understandable, easy terms. We have a YouTube channel and a Substack publication. Really watch the YouTube channel. We're going to break down everything that's happening in global markets in a very simple, easy to digest way. You can go to thebitcoinlayer.com to find both of those things. That's the first thing I'd recommend. And then the second thing I'd recommend would be to read some of the books by Saifedean Ammous. So The Bitcoin Standard, The Fiat Standard, Principles of Economics. Those three things I would read because you're being delivered high quality Austrian economic concepts in a very digestible form. So those are the two things I do to stay up to date and to learn about all this stuff and become literate so you can know what's going on and learn how to read through it all. Go to the Bitcoin layer and to develop, some advanced literacy while keeping it simple, I would visit Saifedean Ammous's website and start reading those books.
Great resources. I love it. Okay, last question for you. So we are just had the halving. We are seem to be entering a, you know, something of a bull market, but it appears that we've also entered the then they fight you stage. I would be curious to hear your projections, thoughts on whether it's price action, new developments that you're anticipating over the next 12 to 18 months in Bitcoin.
For sure. Yeah. Well, one thing's for certain, it's going to be something nobody expects, right? Anyone with certainty in Bitcoin or thinking that they're an expert, they get burned every single time. And so, right now I'd advise, people to only buy what they can afford to lose as per usual. Dollar cost average is really the best way to do it. I personally have no price predictions for this cycle whatsoever. Looking historically, Bitcoin has gone on a 3.5x run following its halving. But again, this cycle is kind of unlike any other. We saw the last two, when in 2016, Bitcoin was a very small asset. So I suppose it didn't really matter. But you know, the macro backdrop during the 2020 halving was really favorable for risk assets. And right now, who knows? It might be less so because rates are where they are. But then again, that has also kind of spurred economic activity. Rates being as high as they are, that means more spending needs to occur, more deficit spending needs to occur, more money goes into the real economy. So it's kind of paradoxical. The Fed's high rates haven't actually slowed economic activity in a way, they've accelerated it. Mm. And so the economic backdrop is shaky. It's one the United States hasn't really experienced before. We've had periods of high inflation and relative to economic activity, but we've never had it where debt to GDP is where it is. So it's really anybody's guess what's going to happen. But what I would say is that Bitcoin as an asset is inevitable because if you zoom out over a multi-decade time frame, you understand that the fiscal and monetary situation deteriorating is an absolute certainty. And like I said, anyone who says they're absolutely certain in Bitcoin is a moron, but on the front of the US government and US treasuries and US Federal Reserve's fiscal and monetary situation, just going off the last 50 years, I feel pretty confident in saying that.
So buy some Bitcoin, lose it in a boating accident. You heard it here from Joe. Joe, why don't you give everyone a handoff and where they can find you, the Bitcoin layer, any other resources you want to point them toward?
Absolutely. So you can find me at Joe Consorti on X, just at, and then the way my name is spelled in the title. And then I'd encourage you all to visit Theia. So Theia is the first Bitcoin native company that's funded by Y Combinator, and for really good reason. We're building out a really sick self-custody product. It is the easiest way to self-custody. And at the end of the day, if we're to bring more people onto this big orange life raft that we call Bitcoin, then it needs to be extremely easy for people to do so without sacrificing on the security. And so Theia is an app you can download on your phone. There is a single sig option that's coming out, a multi-sig option. So whether you're an individual with a little Bitcoin or a family with a lot of Bitcoin that's planning inheritance money, if you're a corporation that has a treasury that would like to allocate to Bitcoin, if you want to help payment processing in Bitcoin, really Theia is changing the game and paving the way when it comes to using Bitcoin the way it was intended, which I feel is the killer app of the rest of the 21st century, right? So I'll leave it at that. You could visit theia.us for more. That's theia.us. And also it's linked in the Twitter bio that I just mentioned previously.
Very cool. Awesome, Joe. Hey, thank you so much for your time, man. Really enjoyed the conversation and hope we get to catch up in person or talk again in the future.
Absolutely, man. Thanks, Michael.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you being here. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Joe. I know I sure did. I think it brought a lot of clarity to concepts I've begun to understand as I go further down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but just brought a bit more clarity to each of those and how some of this stuff really works, practically speaking. Of course, follow Joe, follow the Bitcoin Layer. I need to really dive into more of their stuff because every time I see their content, it's awesome. I just feel like I'm pulled in a lot of different directions when it comes to YouTube channels and newsletters, but I know the Bitcoin Layer is doing some amazing and very important work. And of course, if you need self-custody help, reach out to the Bitcoin Way. We are your white glove go-to guys for this service. We make no compromises. Everything is open source, air-gapped. We don't sell any hardware or software. We just help you set it up right the first time. And of course, follow me on X, Twitter, whatever we call it. It's at the other M Jordan. Reach out if you have questions, comments, suggestions for the show. And you can also subscribe to my personal Bitcoin newsletter, which is blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.